Hi everyone, Benjamin here. Welcome to the February edition of Microbe Talk, the podcast from the Microbiology Society. Now, I am very excited about today's show. This is some really awesome science. Stay tuned as we travel back 800 years or so to the city of Troy and learn about a little microbial detective work. Anand Jagatia takes up the story.
Everyone knows the story of the Trojan horse. It was around 1200 BC, the middle of the Trojan War, and the Greeks had laid siege to the city of Troy. But after 10 years, it still wouldn't fall. So, in a last-ditch effort, they pretended to sail away, leaving behind a parting gift, a giant wooden horse. The Trojans, thinking they had won, wheeled this giant trophy steed inside the city walls. But little did they know, hidden inside the horse was a group of Greek soldiers. Under cover of darkness, these soldiers opened the city gates from the inside, Troy itself was sacked, and the Greeks were victorious. Our story this month is also set in ancient Troy, and actually has a few things in common with this mythical tale. There's no great battle, but there is death. And instead of soldiers hiding inside a horse, it involves some unexpected microbes hiding inside a woman's chest cavity. Now, this woman died around 800 years ago, and was buried in a cemetery from the Byzantine era on the outskirts of Troy.
It was a small cemetery, and the archaeologist who found this woman's remains and characterized them analyzed all of the remains from the cemetery and concluded that the people who lived and died there had a pretty hard life. So they had a lot of wear and tear on their bones and joints, suggesting that they were doing very difficult, probably farming, and had quite short lives.
This is microbiologist Caitlin Pepperell from the University of Wisconsin-Madison in the U.S.
The archaeologist found a couple of nodules that are about the size of strawberries in the chest cavity of this woman who died 800 years ago. These are just chalky, white, crumbly nodules. And the information that she had to go on was their size and, their general appearance. And based on that, she thought very reasonably that these might represent calcified pieces of lung from tuberculosis. But, you know, when we looked at the DNA evidence, that was clearly not the case.
Caitlin is part of the molecular archaeology lab at her university, which studies biomolecules like DNA, proteins, and fats from the ancient world. By analysing these molecules, it's possible to gain a window into what life was like hundreds, if not thousands, of years ago.
You know, based on just looking at bones and the remains of people, it's just a very imprecise measure of disease, for example, if you're trying to figure out what people died from or what diseases they suffered from in the ancient world. You know, many things look very similar on gross examination, but when you have the molecular data, you have a much more precise vision of what happened.
But of course, there are difficulties with using these kinds of methods, as you might imagine when you're looking at biological material from such a long time ago.
There are two problems. One is that the material tends to break down over time, DNA and other chemicals. And then the other issue is that, of course, over these long time periods, you know, you have contaminating material that obscures the signal that you're really looking for. So, you know, for example, soil is full of all kinds of bacteria, and soil will contaminate the bones. And so you have to sort of filter through the signal from the DNA from all of those organisms to try to get at your target.
It's possible to sort out the target's ancient DNA from any younger modern DNA because it has characteristic damage patterns that makes it identifiable. To look at the material from Troy and test the archaeologist's hunch about tuberculosis, Caitlin needed to enlist the help of an ancient DNA expert.
So I contacted Dr. Hendrik Poynar at McMaster University in Canada, and I sent him samples of the nodules from which he extracted DNA and did sequencing or analysis of the DNA. Normally what happens is in these situations is that the target that you're looking for, the true ancient DNA, is a very, very small proportion of all of the DNA present. But what we found in this case was that there was really an amazing abundance of ancient bacterial DNA from two completely unexpected species of bacteria.
The sheer amount of ancient DNA inside these nodules was pretty incredible. Normally, the signal would be completely swamped out by contamination from modern DNA. But in this case, something had happened to preserve the bacterial cells almost perfectly.
We looked at the nodules using scanning electron microscopy, and what we could see were the outlines of bacterial cells and also of the human host cells in this mineral material, this calcified chalky material. What we think happened is that as part of the inflammatory response to this woman's infection, there was a mineralization, so a laying down of this calcium layer that preserved the individual cells and protected the DNA that was inside of them from physical and chemical assaults and damage, and also protected it from contamination.
You can think of this process as forming calcified shells or impressions of the original cells, something that Caitlin refers to as ghost cells.
We could see the outlines of the cells, and also it preserved the architecture of the tissue, so the arrangement of the cells together in this tissue. I showed a picture of the scanning electron micrographs in a presentation that I gave a few months ago, and there was a person in the audience who works on Staphylococcus aureus biofilms, and that's an organism that's related to the bacteria we found in the nodule. And he said that the micrographs looked exactly like pictures that he had taken of these staph biofilms, you know, in the modern era, so living staph biofilms.
The fact that these ghost cells formed inside the nodules meant that the DNA was remarkably well preserved. So what species did these ghosts belong to when they were alive 800 years ago?
The most abundant species is a bacterium called Staphylococcus saprophyticus, and it is well known for causing urinary tract infections. And then the second species is an organism called Gardnerella vaginalis, which is part of the normal human microbiome, but can also cause a range of different infections, some of which are quite severe.
And so do you think that these two species had something to do with the death of this woman?
I do, yes. The amount of bacterial DNA that was present in the nodules suggests that it was a very active infection. So something like an abscess. You know, if we were doing culture, we would have pure growth, probably of both organisms. So I think it's very likely that this led to her death, although, of course, we can't know that for sure.
This is, of course, the obvious caveat with research like this, that we can't know for sure. But it is possible to build up a pretty detailed picture of what might have happened if we have enough evidence. This is Caitlin's theory.
The diagnosis that I thought was most likely was something called chorioamnionitis, which is an infection of, it happens during pregnancy, and it involves the fetus and the membranes around the fetus and the placenta. And it is usually a mixed infection, and Gardnerella vaginalis is a typical bug that's involved. The reason that we thought that I thought it was chorioamnionitis was based on the woman's age and her sex, obviously, and then also the fact that we recovered those two species of organism. The analysis of the chemical composition of the nodules, which suggested they were from inflammation. The appearance of the tissue on scanning electron microscopy, and then probably most importantly, the fact that we recovered small amounts of ancient Y chromosome DNA. And this, we think, originated from her fetus, from a male fetus. And one of the characteristics of chorioamnionitis is that the inflammatory response, so the cells that come and respond to the severe infection, come from both the mother and the fetus.
Just from her anatomy, it wasn't possible to tell that the woman was pregnant. But the amazing thing is that had this woman's unborn child been a girl, it would have had an XXX chromosome, and the researchers probably wouldn't have noticed it was there. The fact that the fetus was male meant that they found the Y chromosome, and this was the last piece of the puzzle. We actually covered a similar story to this one on our blog around this time last year, about Otzi the Iceman. Otzi is a 5,000-year-old mummy frozen in alpine ice, and he is almost perfectly preserved. He still has a lot of his tissues and organs, even pieces of clothing. The woman from Troy, on the other hand, is just a skeleton. And yet, the team involved was able to glean an incredibly rich amount of information from her remains. Although, as Caitlin tells me, this doesn't come easy.
I think an important thing to remember is what careful work it takes to identify material like this. You know, we really, I think, have to give kudos to the archaeologist, whose name is Henrika Kiesewetter, for, you know, looking so carefully through this material and sorting out these chalky little nodules from, you know, rocks and lumps of dirt, basically. It's pretty impressive.
Something a lot of you will be thinking at this point is, okay, it's a cool theory, but how sure can we really be that that's what happened? The nodules, the fetus, the infection, it's a great story. But what if that's all it is? Just a story.
So I, you know, it's interesting. So I see patients in the hospital with infectious diseases and make diagnoses. And in many cases, the quality of the information that I have to base those diagnoses is not as good as what I had for this woman who died 800 years ago.
Really?
Yeah. So, I mean, we don't do extensive characterization of, you know, the DNA sequence from this kind of material as a routine diagnostic test in the hospital. And we certainly don't do scanning electron microscopy or elemental analyses as part of a routine diagnostic workup. So, of course, I can't say for sure what her diagnosis was, but we certainly had very detailed molecular analyses of the tissue to guide us.
Wow, okay. That's not the answer I was expecting, actually, if I'm totally honest. Shifting the focus away from the woman and how she died to the bugs themselves, one species in particular, Staphylococcus saprophyticus, was so well preserved that the team managed to nearly completely reassemble its genome.
When we started, there was very little information about modern Staphylococcus saprophyticus. I think there were two genomes that had been sequenced. So we didn't have much in the way of a context to place this beautiful ancient genome. So we collected, you know, as many strains of saprophyticus as we could get our hands on and sequence them. And then in the meantime, some more genomes were published. And when we put those data together, we saw a fascinating pattern where we had modern urinary tract associated isolates clustering together. And then outside of them, we had this bovine strain that was associated with mastitis from a cow. And then the Troy strain was tucked right in the middle of them. You know, we can't be definitive about it, but we wondered whether the strains that caused disease in the ancient world were from a different pool of bacteria than what causes human disease now. And we speculated that perhaps the pool of bacteria in ancient Troy were sort of these more fluid bugs that could move between humans and livestock. And the reason that, you know, it might be adaptive for the bacteria to be able to do that is that people at that time and in that place typically lived with their livestock, with their cattle.
So how often does a finding like this come around in the field? Is it a rare treat to get to work with ancient molecules that are so well preserved?
I would say, I mean, it's a rare treat to have material of this quality. And this was my first foray into ancient DNA work. My collaborator warned me that it doesn't usually work out this way and I shouldn't get a false sense of the field. Because what's much more typical is that you have, you know, some archaeological material that looks really promising and exciting because the bones have signs of a particular disease, for example. And, you know, you look and look and look and just can't recover any promising material from it. So that's definitely the more typical experience for ancient DNA. So I would say really the treat is to look into some special material that someone has given you and really be able to understand it and learn so much from it.
Do you think that because the material was in such good condition that that makes this quite a significant finding?
I do. I think it teaches us about DNA preservation and about this circumstance that nobody had really thought of, where we have this inflammation-related calcification that leads to extraordinary preservation. So I think it's significant in that sense, and it's significant in terms of really being the most detailed window onto maternal infection from the archaeological record. So, you know, we know, of course, that complications of pregnancy are really important health problems today and certainly have been incredibly important in the past, but have not had any sort of detailed information about these kinds of complications from the archaeological record. And then, you know, it's also the first ancient staphylococcal genome. So the ancient pathogen literature has been focused so far on tuberculosis and leprosy and plague and Helicobacter pylori, all of which are really important infections. And this is the first time that we've gotten a staphylococcal genome. And the related organism Staphylococcus aureus is an incredibly important human pathogen. So having an ancient staph genome is very exciting. And then I think I learned a lot about Staphylococcus saprophyticus, which, you know, has an incredibly complex ecology, and I think has a lot to teach us about how virulence and human pathogenicity emerge from bacteria with a sort of a complex ecological niche.
Now must be quite an exciting time to be working in molecular archaeology. You know, as our sequencing technology gets better and we get better at extracting material from archaeological sites, what aspects of the field are you most excited about as a microbiologist?
You know, I'm really just excited to have the library of ancient pathogens expanded, to have more species and a broader window onto disease in the ancient world. I also think that the field is headed towards analyses of ancient populations. So my hope is that we'll get to a point where, you know, we're not just looking at one genome from one isolate or one organism, but that we can get a window onto a whole population, which enables very powerful analyses and a better understanding of evolution.
Caitlin Pepperell there, talking with Anand Jagatia. So that's it for this month. Thank you all for listening. You can find out more about our work at microbiologysociety.org. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at microbiosoc. You can search for our blog, which is The Microbe Post, and we're on Facebook too. If you've enjoyed the show, please leave us a review or some stars. This month's show was co-produced by Anand and I. I've been Dr. Benjamin Thompson. See you again in a few weeks.